Thank you very much, Philip. Mr. President, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for inviting me to give the MCC Spirit of Cricket Cowdery Lecture. I consider this a tremendous honour, an honour to acknowledge Colin and have the opportunity to share with you some of my experiences as well as some of my thoughts on the game that we all love. I noticed that both Martin Crowe and Adam Gilchrist paid tribute to their families at the start of their speeches. So I trust you will indulge me if I do the same. I should like to thank my wife Vivian, who's here this evening, for her patience and help in putting this lecture together. I should also like to thank my children, Beau and Tom, who are here with me tonight, and Samantha and Mark, who are embracing the spirit of cricket by listening to this lecture the way we used to listen to the tests 60 years ago in the early hours of the morning. Without their love, support and understanding of the demands cricket makes on a family and the time of the family, I would not be able to enjoy all that cricket has given to me. When I received my invitation, I immediately wrote down 10 topics I wanted to address. However, after a month's reflection, I thought I shouldn't indulge myself and that it was more important to confine my speech to the spirit of cricket. However, since arriving in England, I've been told repeatedly that before speaking about the spirit of cricket, I must explain my reasons for sacrificing the most coveted role in world cricket, the England captaincy, to become involved with an Australian television tycoon. A quote from the transcript of my meeting with Kerry Packer 5 days after the centenary test on the 22nd of March 1977 gives the best insight into how I felt at the time. Quote, "Kerry, money is not my major concern. I'm nearly 31 years old. I'm probably 2 or 3 test failures from being dropped from the England team. Ian Botham is going to be a great player, and there won't be room in the England test team for both of us. England captains such as Tony Lewis and Brian Close and Colin Cowdery, Ray Illingworth, Mike Dennis, and perhaps even a few more, all lost the captaincy before they expected to do so. I won't be any different. I don't want to finish up in a mundane job when they drop me. I'm not trained to do anything. I went straight from school to playing for Sussex. I'm at the stage in my life where my family's future is more important than anything else. If you guarantee me a job for life, working in your organisation, I will sign." Unquote. The previous season, cricket with Waverley in the Sydney grade competition created a great thirst to work in Australia. I was not only paid £50,000 for the 5 months' work, but more excitingly, I mixed work-wise and socially with a number of Australia's leading businessmen. This opened my eyes to a world that I didn't know existed. Obviously, there were also key issues with the England administrators that disturbed me, which I felt would never be resolved. I couldn't understand why we were only paid £210 a test when we were playing in front of a packed house or packed houses. The psyche of the administrators, the vast majority of whom I regarded as good friends, was that the honour of playing for England was enough. Money shouldn't be a consideration. Consequently, I couldn't see an end to the game underselling itself, and there appeared to be no hope of expanding the revenue base for Test and county players alike, unless there was a bit of a revolution or at least a big upheaval. Having to make changes to innocuous statements in my books and newspaper articles at the behest of the TCCB at the time was a source of irritation. And having to get permission to take wives on tour and paying more for friends' tickets to the centenary test than I was being paid for playing didn't help much. I've never had any doubt that I did the right thing by my family and by cricket. I've worked for Kerry Packett organisation now for 35 years, and my family's future has been secured. After the initial nastiness, cricket and cricketers also did quite well out of World Series cricket. World Series cricket ensured cricket reinvented itself to survive the changing world. World Series cricket was the jolt the administrators needed, and it flagged the message that they were substantially underselling the sport to the television stations. Players immediately received substantially more money for both test and first-class cricket, which increased the longevity of their careers. Companies saw value in using cricket as a marketing tool. TV coverage improved significantly, which increased interest in the sport. Night cricket created a new audience, both television-wise and at the ground, and generally, decidedly more income. World Series cricket revolutionised cricket pitch preparation through the drop-in pitches. Cricket's success inspired other sports to imitate cricket with things such as TV coverage and sponsorship. I only have two regrets, I think, about World Series cricket. E.W. Swanton was very good to me. And he was very good to me throughout my career, starting way back when I first started playing for Sussex. And I am still saddened that despite numerous attempts by me, I was never able to make peace with him after World Series cricket. It really did upset him. Second, I had a wonderful relationship with the chairman of Selectors, Alec Bedser, which continued through and beyond World Series cricket. I know Alec understood why, but I would like to have told him of my plans before they became public. However, I promised Kerry Packer I wouldn't. I have some great World Series cricket memories, and I'm happy to share them with you, as well as address any World Series cricket issues in question time, if you so wish. And I know Mark Nicholas knows all my stories, and he knows as much about World Series cricket as anyone, so I'm sure he'll drag a bit out of us. That is both myself and Deadly, because I think he should explain his way out of this as well. I played with and against Colin. In so many ways, he embodied all that was good about cricket. There could be no better person after whom to name this lecture. As a batsman, he was calm and graceful. On and off the field, I don't think you could find a more courteous person than Colin. Who else would have called Jeff Thompson Mr. Thompson? And I was down the other end and I heard it and I couldn't believe it. Neither could Tomo, by the way. In the 1990s, Colin and another hero of mine, who's here tonight and I've had the pleasure of saying good evening and shaking his hand, former Sussex and England captain Ted Dexter, were so concerned about the decline in sportsmanship in cricket, they campaigned successfully to have a description of the spirit of cricket included in the preamble to the laws of the game. We are seriously indebted to both of them for their work. When you talk about the spirit of cricket, you're talking about not just a game, but the way you live your life. You're talking about embracing the traditions of the game and sharing your experiences with friends and cricket lovers alike. You're talking about caring for people less fortunate than us. This has been done for years through organisations such as this one, the MCC, the Lord's Taverners, and the Primary Club, and more recently through foundations and organisations set up by many of the current and former players. The spirit of cricket is not just about adhering to the laws of the game. It's about something far more enduring, adhering to a set of values that can evaluate you, that can elevate you above the humdrum, above the cynicism that can drag you down if you let it. It not only covers uniting the various peoples in countries such as India, Sri Lanka, and the countries of the West Indies, but it also brings light to the lives of hundreds of millions of people in those countries as well as in Pakistan and Bangladesh. In particular, the spirit of cricket is about putting the game's interests before yours and your country's interests. Many people have romanticised our game because it does lend itself to that. Which other sport can generate substantial newspaper column inches over the equivalent of the suspense created by five successive maidens? Cricket is also a partnership. Sometimes cricket can feel like it's given you everything. The moment when you score a test 100 or score the winning run on a village green when you were batting at number 11. At other times it gives you nothing. A string of ducks, a dropped catch. But as with all great loves, you never walk away. You accept the bad times, the sacrifices, and the sacrifices you make to participate in this wonderful game, the one the poets call the summer game. Give your hand to cricket and it will take you on the most fantastic journey, a lifetime journey both on and off the field. That's what it's done for me, and I expect for many of you as well. People around the world love sport, but none in my experience in the same profound way that people love cricket and what it stands for. I love cricket because apart from the skill required to succeed at the game, it's a great leveller. It's also a wonderful test of temperament and a test of courage. I love it for the people it has introduced me to, lifelong friendships with people from across the globe. I particularly love it for the opportunities it provides for old folk like us to get together as we have done today. I love it for the wonderful spectacle it continues to be in a world that is changing so fast, in the world of Facebook, the web, Twitter, text messages, and tattoos. I'll never understand those, I've got to tell you that. Stuart, I hope you haven't got a tattoo. I know Deadly hasn't, I can tell you that. And I'm damn sure Ted Dexter hasn't. You still can't see anything to match the rhythms of a test match. Cricket moves to charm, and even in the 21st century, it still has the grace of timelessness. Yehudi Menuhin once said of one of Beethoven's great works, the Pastoral, that Beethoven wrote it, but God approved it. Whether it's a game of cricket on an English green, an Indian maidan, a Caribbean beach, an Australian park, or right here at Lord's with the ancient pavilion looking on, I believe that is also true of cricket. We humans created it, but God approved it. It has its scandals, it has its challenges, fitting into a 21st century where a lot of me-first values of different generations clash with the distinctive beauty of cricket. But people still play and follow cricket in remarkable numbers because the relationship to it is different from any other game. We have in our audience people of greatness in their chosen fields: music, the arts, business, science and politics. Offer them a chance to play a village green match tomorrow and they will invent any excuse to get out of the office. You can play and love cricket with the same deep-rooted attachment at absolutely any level. And here's another thing that makes our game unique. One of the first things scientific researchers do when they start a project... I'll just start that again. And here's another thing that makes our game unique. One of the first things scientific researchers do when they start a project is to read the literature, to find out what is already known. When it comes to the literature, no other sport, not even the Americans with Red Smith and Roger Kahn, has ever produced anything as magnificent as cricket's great writers. Heading them up, of course, the incomparable Cardus and the poet Arlott. I preface the following comments by saying I have only considered our game from the narrow perspective of the 10 full members of the ICC. Lord Wolf, in his recent report to the ICC, looked at the global picture and took into account the views of the 95 associated and affiliated members, and consequently has a more negative view than I. I actually believe that our game is in reasonably good shape. More people play it than ever before. Run rates are often substantially higher than in the golden years of cricket. More women are involved as both players and spectators. Television audiences are up substantially. We have expanded our product range, tests, one-day internationals and 2020s, to cater for the different needs of players and spectators alike. Global revenue has gone through the roof. Substantially more players make a decent living. Crikey, these England players these days even have food tasters and someone to tuck them into bed at night. It's a very different game. In the old days, people used to say, the sun never set on the British Empire. Today, cricket has grown so much that it is probably watched on television somewhere in the world 24 hours a day. Sure, there are issues that need attention, some even urgent attention. But this has always been the case. It's part of the evolution of the game. At the risk of oversimplifying things, the major problems facing cricket at the moment are the decline in the image of cricket, ICC's control, the international calendar and the mix of different types of cricket, gambling, the decision review system, governance, unequal resources, and the possibility of India cherry-picking the Wolf Report to increase its power. Fortunately, I think most of the problems can generally be addressed if India invokes and adheres to the spirit of cricket. Mahatma Gandhi said, quote, "A nation's culture resides in the hearts and in the soul of its people," unquote. As cricket certainly resides in the hearts and the souls of Indian people, I'm optimistic that India will lead cricket by acting in the best interests of all countries rather than just for India. If there is proof of the leadership India can provide, it is in the recent announcement of the one-time benefit payment of $13 million to former national and domestic players for their services to Indian cricket. This certainly exemplifies acting in the spirit of cricket and rewards those players who played before 2003 for little financial reward. That people like Chandrasekhar, Prasanna, Border and Nadkarni will have this sort of financial support as they cope with the onset of the years is a powerful sign that India can not only generate great wealth for the game, but use it wisely for the benefit of cricket and cricketers. Sledging. All since its inception, cricket has been synonymous with fair play. It's not cricket, just another way of saying it's not right, was an expression used throughout the English-speaking world, not just in cricket-playing countries. It was a gentleman's game more than any other sport, and people who played and the people who followed cricket knew they were special. Along the way, my generation decided that the game would be more exciting and more testing if we turned up the heat on the funny quips and used them to intimidate the opposition. History suggests most people of mine and subsequent generations also embraced the new gladiatorial environment. On reflection, I wouldn't have had it any other way. But I have to acknowledge that we not only breached the spirit of cricket, but it is probably a selfish attitude. As a result of sledging, I don't think following generations inherited a game which was as special in the community's eyes as that which my generation inherited. Sadly, these days, captains don't earn or receive the same adulation that Richie Beno and Sir Frank Worrell rightly received in their day. Players also no longer have the same relationship with each other that, say, Keith Miller and Dennis Compton had. Crikey, at times when I watched Ricky Ponting and Duncan Fletcher who were sitting in the stand and Andrew Simons and Habijan Singh on the field, I thought I was back in the 60s and 70s watching Billy Bremner and Nobby Styles chopping down opponents. I suspect who runs cricket, and this is about the ICC, I suspect who runs cricket and how well it has been run have been contentious issues since the beginning of time. Irrespective of the existence of the ICC or its forerunners, for about the first 100 years, cricket was run by England and Australia. Both countries, proud advocates of democracy, ironically, even had a veto on the ICC or its equivalent. Unfortunately, on many occasions, self-interest was more important than the spirit of cricket, and countries such as India and New Zealand, to name two, were undoubtedly discriminated against. Before examining the specific issues, I must acknowledge and praise India for embracing the spirit of cricket through the financial opportunities it provides, which has enabled a number of test-playing countries to survive and some even to thrive. World cricket would be in a sorry state if it weren't for the money shared with other countries from India's television deals. You can imagine the indebtedness of those cricket boards which are able to negotiate a tour with the Board of Control for Cricket in India to their country. It generates a spike in the host country's revenue that will not be seen again until India chooses to come back the next time. World cricket would also struggle if India didn't have sophisticated administrators. More recently, India has found a way to involve its wealthiest entrepreneurs and Bollywood stars, and they've done that through the ownership of its IPL team. So they are a huge force. Today, many people level the problems of the game at the ICC. Technically, they are correct, but in practice, most members of the ICC have little control over many of the important issues of the game. Currently, there are 10 full members of the ICC, and the Constitution requires the approval of 70% or 7 members to advance any motion, which means that 40% or 4 members can block absolutely anything. Much of the game is controlled by the BCCI because it controls enough votes to block any proposal put forward at the ICC board meetings. The reason for this is some countries would not survive without the financial opportunities India provides. What is just as disturbing is through the Champions League, South Africa and Australia have a partnership with India and are unlikely to risk offending her. The current Champions League 10-year contract generates just under $1 billion and is 50% owned by India, with Australia and South Africa sharing the rest. As a result of the dependence on India, the process adopted by the ICC is simply not working. The ICC Cricket Committee, for example, is made up of a group of top-class current and former cricketers and umpires. They go to great lengths to make recommendations that they consider in the best interests of the game. These recommendations are then submitted to the Chief Executive's Committee for approval, which normally happens as a formality. The recommendations are then raised at the ICC board meeting, and this is where it goes wrong, and if India doesn't like them, they are at best modified or thrown out. It's a sorry state of affairs and very frustrating for those who give so much time in their efforts to get things right. India's apparent indifference towards Test cricket, its response towards some of the key issues, the international calendar and the mix of different types of cricket, its attitude to the earlier ICC corruption inquiries, its indifference to the urgency to introduce anti-doping rules, the rumoured corruption hanging over the IPL, its attitude to the decision review system, and its role in the lack of due process in stopping former Australian Prime Minister John Howard being appointed Vice President of the ICC, are all examples, in my view anyhow, of disappointing decisions. But many of the problems of the ICC could be resolved if India invoked the spirit of cricket and didn't try to influence its allies on how to vote. The international calendar and the mix of cricket. In my view, every international team should be required to play at least 3 tests, 3 one-day internationals, and 3 2020 matches against all the other teams in a given home and away cycle. The Future Tours program is managed by the ICC, and it provides guidelines to its members. The ICC tries to impose minimums. However, the various big guns don't like the idea of being tied to these minimums, So they agreed to the minimums, but introduced an unless otherwise agreed clause, which in effect allows all four members to do exactly as they please. In a perfect world, no consideration should be given to any domestic tournaments. That is the IPL, the Big Bash, the Champions League, all of them, before the international calendar is set in stone. No domestic competition should take precedence over international matches. Unfortunately, India is preoccupied with money and 2020 cricket, and sees its IPL and Champions League as more important than a proper international calendar. To compound the problem, India has not only sold part of the game to private interests, but some of her administrators are seen to have a conflict of interest, which makes it a little bit more difficult for them to act in the spirit of cricket. 2020 has played a crucial role in creating interest in cricket to a new audience. The funds it generates at both international and domestic level also help underwrite all other cricket. The IPL has produced a wonderful opportunity for players from all cricketing countries to mix in a way that Martin Luther King would have never dreamed. But the IPL is too long in its current form. Many players have paid ridiculous sums of money, and young players are brought from other countries when they should be learning their craft in the domestic competitions, and the Indian board is more beholden to the private franchise owners than it is to the fellow ICC members. A net result of this is Test cricket is suffering. Some players appear not to have the same feeling for Test matches as their predecessors. There are more and more meaningless one-day international matches. Governing bodies have lost control of some of their players, and some players are abandoning their responsibilities to their home countries. We can huff and puff as much as we like, and have all sorts of external reports done, but this situation can only be resolved by India accepting that the spirit of cricket is more important than generating billions of dollars. It's more important than turning out multimillionaire players, and it's more important than getting square with Australia and England for their bully boy tactics towards India over the years. It's ironic that the world, including India, rightly worship at the Nelson Mandela altar because of his conciliatory attitude, but then India eschews his approach by indulging in a little payback. Although the current test ranking system is working well, I think a playoff for the test crown is absolutely essential. Test cricket is still paramount in England, South Africa and Australia, but disappointingly it is no longer as important in India as it once was. Sadly, Pakistan can't play tests at home, and the West Indies has big problems, which have diminished the standing of their test cricket. The euphoria in India after it won the one-day International World Cup was absolutely amazing. The euphoria was not duplicated when India became number one test team in the world. Cricket will only have its priorities right when Pakistan and the West Indies are given a helping hand and their tests become more meaningful, and when Indian players and people celebrate their success at test level as much as they did when it won the one-day International World Cup. That can probably only happen by having playoffs for test supremacy, say once every 4 years. The ICC's internal executive was bitterly disappointed that India was responsible for canning the scheduled 2013 Test Championship. Unless India embraces the spirit of cricket, I wouldn't hold my breath about the scheduled 2017 championship taking place. DRS. I was involved in the embryonic stages with Channel 9 developing tools to aid the viewer in judging umpiring decisions, and have been a passionate supporter of the DRS system, well, I suppose all through the years. I do, however, accept that it's hard to argue against people such as Rodney Cavalier. He's the current chairman of the Sydney Cricket Ground Trust, who in opposing the DRS said this, and it's interesting, quote, "Cricket is fantasy. It is the intersection of heaven and earth. It cannot ever be a slave of certainty. The essence of cricket is honour and accepting the umpire's decision, unquote. Very interesting. Now, having acknowledged that, I still argue that it's just as important that we get the decisions right. It can't be good for the game when the media devotes so many words and so much ink to bad decisions, which ultimately undermines the integrity of some results. The DRS is not perfect, but it does err in favour of the umpires. Decisions and the umpires' decisions, and according to the ICC, fewer mistakes are made with its use. And furthermore, apparently, there's less conflict on the ground when it is being used. India has two reasons for opposing the DRS. One, because its superstars had such an embarrassing experience with it in the early days. Two, the BCCI argues that the DRS is too inexact. Ironically, the spirit of cricket is batting on both sides in this one. The cavalier approach says DRS is not in the spirit of cricket, but on the other hand, the Indian superstars and board should act in the spirit of cricket and accept the majority viewpoint. Gambling. These days you can't talk about cricket without dwelling on the ongoing damage match fixing and game manipulation has caused the sport. I share the world's view that it's repugnant and that cricket administrators should adopt a zero tolerance policy. Currently, all ICC member players' contracts contain clauses prohibiting match fixing, and all contracted players are required to sign off on the education program provided by the ICC prior to taking part in any international match. The boards have also spelt out exactly what a player's obligation is if any approach is made by anyone in relation to corruption. For example, there is an ICC anti-corruption and security representative at every international match. In fact, in some countries, they're at all first-class games as well. Players are encouraged to go either directly to their management or alternatively go directly to the ICC anti-corruption and security representative. Sadly, this hasn't been sufficient to eliminate corruption. Short of all players agreeing to take a lie detector test, I don't know how corruption can be eliminated completely. I think all players should agree to take lie detector tests, and all should agree that if they fail the tests, they would give the officials access to their bank accounts and records and phone records. My expectation is that only a handful of players might fail the test, and therefore it would not be an onerous commitment by 99.9% of the players. Some players embrace the bookies or their representatives for financial gain or because of threats to their family, and one should never underestimate that. It's not necessarily all about money. Or because a young, naive player feels beholden to a captain he idolises. Ironically, I think lie detector tests would be in the interests of the vulnerable players because it would lessen the chance of approaches from bookies and captains. Knowing that they would be caught through the lie detector test would lessen the chance of the player trying to either make a quick dollar or capitulating to the bookmaker threats. Obviously, agreeing to take lie detector tests would be a huge invasion in privacy, but no more so than accepting a stranger knocking on your door at 5 a.m. asking for you to provide a urine sample. It's a huge sacrifice, but I think it would be in the spirit of cricket for players to agree to it. Governance. I should like to express my dismay not only at the proliferation of external reports telling us what changes need to be made, but also governments throughout the cricket world telling us how to run the game. I don't know whether current administrators lack the knowledge and courage to make decisions for the sport. Perhaps it's a bit of both. Or more likely, they are being a little sneaky and pushing responsibility for unpopular decisions to an external source. In recent times, Cricket Australia, the ECB and the ICC all commissioned external reports. The ICC investigation was undertaken by Lord Wolfe, and his key recommendations were never going to be accepted, no chance in the world. Basically, Lord Wolfe was recommending the equivalent of the United States, Russia, China, the United Kingdom and France giving up their vetoes in the Security Council, or the House of Lords voting itself out of existence. I mean, it was fairy tale stuff, really. Believe it or not, The reason for outside independent expert reports is that anything put forward by, say, the ICC executive is perceived to be agenda-driven by someone. What a sorry state of affairs. What a cop-out. I want cricket people running cricket in the best interests of cricket, not outsiders reading from a textbook. Over the years, cricket has been severely damaged by government interference in South Africa and Pakistan and Sri Lanka and Zimbabwe and India. England has been subjected to government interference, and recently the Australian government urged Cricket Australia to improve its governance. Obviously, all cricketing boards need to comply with the laws of the land in respect of corruption, etc., and all need to improve their governance. But the governance should be done at their own initiative and members' behest, and not with governments holding a gun at their heads. Unequal resources. There is obviously a substantial difference in available resources between the haves, India, England, Australia, and South Africa, and the have-nots, the West Indies, Pakistan, New Zealand, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and Zimbabwe. This creates many problems. The have-nots' youngsters are less likely to be attracted to cricket. It's far more difficult for those countries to develop the players, and perhaps more importantly, players from have-not countries in 2020 competitions than in playing tests for their own countries. Once again, this problem could be addressed if all countries invoked the spirit of cricket and made some sacrifices. The following comments provide a solution in my provide a solution to my earlier observation about the international calendar and the IPL, and paradoxically, the IPL might just prove to be a solution. One, India should agree to reduce the length of the IPL in its current form as a trade-off for the other countries not scheduling internationals in opposition to it. That is, unless it adopts my Asian League proposal, which I shall discuss in a minute. Two, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, New Zealand and the West Indies agreed not to schedule any internationals in opposition to the IPL. These countries will never be able to generate enough income to make internationals in the long term more attractive to their players than the IPL money. Three, India should agree to expand the IPL to, say, an Asian league and include extra teams from Sri Lanka, Bangladesh and Pakistan. The cricket boards of these countries should be given a financial interest in the competition, which would enable them to underwrite most of their cricket. Those funds would compensate the boards for not running domestic 2020 competitions of their own, as they are planning to do now. This expanded league would enable players from the have-not countries to earn good money and still be available to play in internationals. Four, England should set up its equivalent of the IPL and include teams from the West Indies and one team from, say, Ireland, which would have a financial interest in the competition. Similar arrangements should be made in South Africa for Zimbabwe and Kenya, and Australia's Big Bash should include New Zealand. Five, World Cricket should do everything possible to not only help the West Indies become a dominant test force again, but to ensure Pakistan cricket survives the extraordinary situation in which it now finds itself. As I've expressed a number of times throughout this speech, I believe most of the existing problems can be solved by India if it embraces the spirit of cricket and leads for world cricket, not just for India. However, there is a potential problem which would negate my optimism. Lord Wolfe recommended that the president of the ICC become a ceremonial role and that a new position of an independent chairman be created. He recommended that the chairman serve for 3 years and that the position be remunerated. This person would be the most powerful person in world cricket. Although India has rejected the Wolf report, I am concerned that it will cherry-pick and support this recommendation or a watered-down version in a motion to change the existing constitution of the ICC. The worry is that India has enough clout to control the position forever. I should like to conclude by saying that cricket, a 19th century game, has survived and thrived in the 21st century because the spirit of cricket had been just as important to cricket-playing countries and democracies as Shakespeare has been to the world. Cricket, as we know and love it, has plenty of problems. Most of those problems can be solved if the ICC members put the game's interests before their own interests. If India accepts the survival of Test cricket is non-negotiable. If India accepts its responsibility as leader of the cricket world. If it embraces Nelson Mandela's philosophy of not seeking retribution. It embraces the spirit of cricket and governs in the best interests of world cricket, not just for India and its business partners. All those things need to be addressed so that cricket's own great journey can continue. The one that began on the wheels of Kent and the downs of Hampshire and, of course, found its way north so that that canny Yorkshireman, Captain James Cook, could set it off towards Australia and New Zealand. And it has found its way to the East and the West Indies and my native South Africa. And they're beginning to play it in all sorts of exotic locations. What we have is a game with its roots deep in the 19th century, but like a magnificent English oak, continues to spread its luxuriant branches into the 21st century. If we want our children's children's children to be able to climb on that tree, share in what we are lucky enough to share in this room today, we must do everything in our power to ensure that that tree can live. To do that, no matter where we come from in the world, no matter what our religion or our hue, we must be guided by the paramount and enlightening thing that Colin Cowdery knew and cherished so well, the spirit of cricket. Thank you.